From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Big Change Pope.
Hi, Dan. With a new name for me, I see.
It's a challenge every time I come up with a new name.
Why did you choose Dr. Big Change?
Because we're talking about today about trying to change education for the better and using a lot of resources to do so. Did you know that after health, education is the second largest sector of the economy?
I've heard you say that before, but I haven't really thought it through. So when you say that, you mean in terms of money, employees, everything?
Yeah. It globally as well. It is a giant, giant enterprise. You know, it's got so much going on. So I'm trying to think of how, if I were going to change education and I were going to go after one thing, I had that silver bullet mentality, where would I go? What would I do? Where would I invest to make the change?
Am I supposed to guess what you would do, or are you asking me what I would do? I'm going to throw it right back to you and say, okay, Dan.
I've been totally busted in my rhetorical style.
You have. What would you do, Dan Schwartz, dean of the School of Education?
I would first go by analogy. So I'd try and think of who has the most power in health.
Oh, interesting. You know, so like, who has the most power in health?
I don't know. But a big pharma, maybe, or insurance companies. So if I do the analogy in education, I sort of look at test prep. Test prep is sort of the biggest moneymaker outside of schools in the education enterprise. So if I were going to go after anything, I would go after the test makers.
And you would try to make them change the tests to be better? I mean, when you say you're using that as a lever.
I think however we change the tests, I think lots of other things will follow from that.
So I have a totally different view, which probably doesn't surprise you. I am a student of Larry Cuban and David Tyack, and I go for a much different lever, which is the school and maybe even district-based lever. And instead of trying to change ETS or College Board or go that route, I go, which is what I do in real life, kind of school by school, changing it on the ground. I think we probably need a little bit of both.
How many are there of you?
You mean how many? One? Is that what you're saying? No, but we hit lots of different schools. But you're right. It's a slow going process. It's a tinkering, to quote Larry and David.
Yeah.
But I feel like too many people can close the door, right? Too many people can kind of wait out the storm. And I really don't want to give more power than they already have to the testing.
So we could just get rid of the test.
Well, okay.
You'd like that. Now we're talking. Okay. Very good. Today, we're very lucky to have Mr. Jim Shelton with us. He is the head of the education arm of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. And so that initiative works to end disease and improve education. And Jim is responsible for the education part. Jim has an amazing background, which he's hesitant to speak about just because he's a modest guy. But let me just say, he's an alum of Stanford.
Woohoo!
And the GSE, go team. He spent 6 years in the Obama administration in roles at the U.S. Department of Education and rising to deputy secretary. And then he led My Brother's Keeper, which was an initiative to help African-American boys in the Obama administration. And of course, as I said, he's now taking on the very large responsibility of thinking how to use the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative to make education better for as many and in the best directions. So welcome, Jim.
Morning.
I guess I'm going to ask the easy question, which is how did you get into this? How did you even get into this work in the first place?
The interesting thing is that the very first thing that I thought, other than the dad, the very first thing I thought I wanted to be was a teacher.
Yay.
And so I started down that path. Unfortunately, my mom was not down with that plan.
Interesting. I
was good in math and science, and she thought that I had the opportunity to be an engineer or something that would be lucrative. And so she basically forbade me from pursuing teaching and insisted that I do that. Now, luckily, I love computers. love computers and technology and all kinds of things like that. Even as a little kid, I would like wander into this giant room at the time, dating myself, that had computers in our government building. And
punch cards.
I think they were just past the punch cards and had the terminals with the green screens. So anyway, so that's kind of how I started off, was wanting to be in education. One of the reasons I discovered that something was wrong and what I thought was something must be wrong in the education system is I remember being in third grade helping one of my best friend's brother who was in sixth grade with his homework. And we went to different schools, and I was like, something is wrong here, because he's definitely smarter than I am. All of them were smarter than I was. And so why does he not know what I already know? Mm. And so anyway, so after that, I did major in computer science, and I did start off my career doing systems development work. I did, though, some reason think that if I really wanted to make money, I should get out of technology and go to business school. But because all along I was like volunteering, I was substitute teaching, I was working in youth emergency shelters and youth courts, and I thought I'd be in education in the long term after I like made this fortune or whatever I was supposed to be doing.
First make the money, make your mom happy, and then do it.
I decided to, while I was here, getting my graduate degree in business, to get my graduate degree in education as well. And then I wound up insisting when I started my career in business to doing pro bono work alongside my work in business, and which I was working with school systems and cities and communities and improving. And then over the course of time, I stayed in business for a while and then realized that if I didn't start doing the work in education that I wanted to do, I might never get to it. And so I left the world of management consulting, started actually trying to build organizations that provided great schooling opportunities for kids in their communities, and then wound up working for both for-profits and nonprofits that invested in people trying to do the same thing, and then wound up in the Gates Foundation and the Obama administration, and now with a brief stint at an ed tech company called 2U, which I loved, and then Chan Zuckerberg.
Wow. Well, it's this sort of thing, maybe looking backwards, it makes sense, but predicting it going forward from like an 18-year-old, it's just impossible to imagine this kind of path. As a faculty member, I used to think the worst thing in the world was having good ideas and no money. But having sort of moved to the dean role, I'm beginning to realize maybe the worst thing is to have money and no good ideas, that the responsibility is really high. So CZI, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, is going to invest a lot of money. How do you go about making decisions about where to invest? Like, do you just talk to every single person alive and tally it up?
Yeah, because that's feasible.
What I will say is, even with the years of experience and all that good stuff, our very first step is always listen. Go talk to people doing the work. Go talk to the students. Go see it for yourself. Understand what the underlying problems are. Understand how people describe the problems. And then look harder to see, is that really it? Or is there something else that they may or may not be seeing that actually represents at least part of the issue that they're dealing with? And so there is a part of this that's about listening to what people say matters to them, listening to the solutions that they propose, and then seeing how that fits into the broader context. That is one of the things you have the benefit of having when you get to sit back from the work as a funder. Additionally, I have the opportunity to look across other sectors to see how do things happen. Like, how does innovation happen in one sector that is different than education versus how it happens in education? Should it? Are there any analogs about how it ought to apply and how it ought not apply in the education space? And so we spend a lot of time thinking about, like, what could we learn from these other places that might benefit the education space? And then the third thing is that you then, once you've crafted your ideas, you ask a lot of people to get in and engage with you. One thing I learned from one of the guys I worked with in the Obama administration who came from Silicon Valley is this thing called Joy's Law. And it's very simple. It just says, no matter who you are, most of the smartest people in the world don't work for you. Right?
And so, Not true.
wait. I work for Dan.
No. I was trying to head that off.
Thank you. Okay, keep going.
Anyway, so all that to say that even once you think you identify the problems that you're trying to solve, even when you think that you've identified solutions, both getting other people to give you feedback, but also creating ways that you go about finding the best ideas that are about enlisting other people, the smartest people in the world, wherever they happen to be, to help you solve these problems, That's a big deal.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking today with Jim Shelton, head of the education arm of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, talking about change and learning from across different fields on the best way to make that.
So I recently got an email survey from a university that's going through their visioning process. And I was given a menu of things to vote for that should be on their vision. I thought this seems less labor intensive as a way to go about it. You just crowdsource the decision, get a vote from random people.
But they had to come up with the initial things. Yes or no? They just crowdsource that too.
Physics, biology.
But I think that, you know, if you just tally up a survey and take the most popular answer, then I think you're missing the opportunity for a lot of insight.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you are serious about gleaning from people what their real insights are, what their lessons are, what their patterns are that they recognize, especially in a space like ours where we've not had the benefit of an NIH and some of these other folks that have studied things for years and years with billions and billions of dollars.
That's National Institute of Health, right?
Oh, yeah, National Institute of Health. Thanks for explaining. Like building off of people's intuitions and then forming real hypotheses and then using the funding to test them out and figure out what works for whom in what context, like that's a lot of what we're trying to do.
So have you decided on places to place your bets?
So we're placing our bets in, I think, three really important areas. The first thing is that one of the things that we deeply believe is that we've allowed ourselves to start to too narrowly define the purpose of education, that human beings, young children especially, have a comprehensive set of developmental opportunities and needs, whether it's their physical health, their mental health, their social-emotional development, their sense of identity, whether it's their individual or group identity, as well as their cognitive skills and academic skills. And by overly narrowing that definition, we both miss the importance of the foundational elements in those other things, as well as the outcome goals we should be shooting for to have fully fulfilled human beings who are able to execute on all those dimensions of their life. So we're trying to do the work to say, okay, not only do we want to call attention to these other dimensions that are really important, but understand, like, how do you know if you're doing a good job developing them in young children? How do you know if they have a delay? What kinds of interventions work to support them? And in what kind of environments do you need to implement them for that to work? So that's one really big, important part of work, because it's a shift for the education space to think that broadly about children in many cases.
So is this often called the whole child?
It's definitely called the whole child work. Mm-hmm. I use that most often, but I often like to call it all the way out because those couple of words mean so many things to so many people.
Yeah.
Just like social-emotional learning means different things to different people. So I try to be careful not to just say that and I let people run away with it, because I think all those dimensions are actually really important.
So Denise, I was right. We need to get ETS, Educational Testing Service, to make the whole child assessment.
Make
the test.
Look at Jim's face. See? He wasn't right, was he, Jim? He wasn't.
Well, what I want to say is that I think that one of the things we've learned is that if you don't give people a really good hypothesis about what it means to do a good job of developing things in children, then they will could act on bad hypotheses that could turn out to be harmful. So let me give you an example. So people love to rail on No Child Left Behind, right?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And you said and these assessments. But the reality and the annual assessments. But let's say that going into No Child Left Behind, people had the hypothesis that the way you produce really great annual outcomes for children is to create school environments full of joy and love, that you had to give them a very rich curriculum that was comprehensive, that included the arts and music, and that deep relationships with those students and using evidence-based practice that was rooted in science was the best thing to do through those relationships. Let's say that everybody who decided to try and attack how to, you know, not wind up on the failing list and how to do well on their annual assessments believed those things as No Child Left Behind came out. I think we feel really differently about it than we do now when people, and most people, responded to it by stripping down the curriculum, doubling up on the core reading and math hours, and for, as like lots of teachers and students would say, stripping all of the good parts out of school.
This is School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Jim Shelton, head of the education arm of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, on making changes and how you decide where to start. And I think your assumption, I mean, what an amazing thing if all the schools actually had fulfilled the assumptions that you just said about, you know, a climate of care and a focus on joy and engagement. Then maybe No Child Left Behind wouldn't have had some of these results, because that would have been baked in to the foundation. Is that what you're saying?
That's a big part of what I'm saying. And so I do think that having measures, some way of measures, I don't even call them measures, ways of gathering evidence about our children progressing, they want you to progress. Like, we need them. We have to have them. How do you tell a teacher how to improve if you can't tell her what's happening with her students? How do you tell a parent what's going on with their child and how to support them if you can't tell them whether they're growing in the ways that you might expect or the ways that they need to? So you have to find those ways to do it, but both how you use them and then what hypothesis you give people, or tools, frankly, you give people to make do a better job at meeting the needs of each child. Like, that's the really important part.
I think that's really hard, because people have in their head a bias for a paper and pencil test or on computer test. And they think that they've got all this history of how schools have measured kids, and we measure learning through tests that look like, you know, multiple choice, pick the right answer, academic test. And when you try to talk to them about alternative ways of giving that kind of feedback or assessment, they feel it's not rigorous or it's not accurate or you can't scale it.
Also, but I think that's where the challenge comes, right? Which is, we have always struggled to figure out, how do you do for each child, each and every child, the thing that is difficult to even do well for one? And so for us, like, that is a big part of this, which is, you can't say you're pursuing equity and you can't say you're pursuing equality for children if you're not thinking about both how to do it well for each child and how to do it well for each and every child. And that's the tension that we have, because people get nervous about when you start talking about doing things like big testing companies because you can touch everyone, or using technology because it's cheaper than lots of other ways of accessing folks. But in the end, if you want to be able to touch everyone, you've got to create systems that enable that. And as you pointed out at the very beginning, education is one of the biggest sectors that we have. It's big in terms of money. It's big in terms of people. I think, I'm not sure exactly where teaching falls in terms of the ranking of total people in a profession, but it's way, way up there. And so if you say, I need to equip every single teacher to do the work of their lives every day, both in terms of their own competences and the tools they have available to them, you got to think really creatively about, what does it look like to do that?
Is that even possible? That's a heavy lift.
No, I think you can. It's funny. So education has become more evidence-based, and I don't think people know that.
Can you explain what that means, Sam?
So I think a lot of people think education should be sort of their imagination of what they wanted their childhood to be. It's kind of a normative endeavor. Schools should be this because this is what I think schools should look like. And that's good. At the same time, I think we're now developing evidence that says this will help you achieve that goal. This will help you achieve that goal. I think that's fairly new. And so we need to figure out how to get this evidence out to the educators.
Can I kind of a slightly different angle, though?
Sure.
So if you don't think it's possible, who do you think ought to get the teachers that aren't prepared and that don't have the tools they need?
I'm totally with you. I think it has to be possible, right?
That's the answer.
Because that's the system. And that is a great place to say that this is School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. And we are coming back to hear more with Jim Shelton and the answers to how we do that heavy lift on helping teachers and schools really reach all kids. Next on SiriusXM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Jim Shelton, head of the education arm of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and we were going to get an answer on how we were going to fix this problem, Jim, how we were going to make schools work for every kid everywhere.
Denise says teachers. Dan says tests. Jim wisely is going to say, you know, just there's no silver bullet. But
you're correct. There's no silver bullet, as much as I wish there were. What we want to do is start with the vision of what we actually want for children, and that is that we actually develop them as whole children. That's not just their academic skills, but more comprehensively all those other things that I talked about. I think we also need to recognize that the science is pretty clear that children are different. They learn in different ways. They have different needs. And so across all those dimensions, you could think of so many different permutations about how you meet the needs of a child and how their families and their schools will intersect in trying to meet their needs. And so this need for personalization, the need to personalize the approaches that you're taking to each child is very important. Now, what we've really just finished talking about, though, is the more you try and do that, the more difficult you make the overall task of reaching each and every child. So then the question becomes, well, what is the combination of the skills that teachers need and the tools they need to have in their hands and the interfacing and the exchanges that we need to have between parents and school to meet the needs of every single child? And it's a really hard problem, but the good news is, like, that is a bounded problem. Like, we can know we can create these kinds of experiences and these kinds of environments. We do it in small scale for many, many kinds of children. We just haven't figured out how to do it for everyone. And so that's the work that we're embarking on. There's three parts to it once you've got, like, that as your big challenge. One is we got to fill in some of the gaps around what it means to be a wholly developed child and how you do it. We have to figure out what these tools are and how to get them in the hands and engineer them so lots and lots of people can have access to them. And then you got to go through the change process of building the capacity of the adults in a child's life to help them figure out how they do this work well. And that's teachers most of all, I think. But parents always play that first role. And no one is going to be successful until we figure out how to help them understand how to maximize the impact that they can have. So that's the work that we're doing. We're taking it in chunks. One is getting this definition stuff right, and then we can move on to how you provide models and tools that help.
So it's an interesting statement where oftentimes when people think of education, they think of certain values. And your approach is to say, no, there's these very high-order values, the whole child, and there are objective ways to achieve that which won't be value-laden. Or that's the bet, is that the science can help us figure out ways to achieve the whole child, even though different children may be different and parents' desires for their children may be different.
So I think that there are things that we will learn through the science that are objective about the ways that you both support and stymie children to develop across all these dimensions. Glasses, they help kids see.
Yeah.
Like, we know
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And so there are things that we can know about each one of these domains that's true like that. I think the approaches that people take to doing those things that can be rooted in evidence may be very different, right? We're having this really good conversation among our team because when you think about schools that do this kind of work, people almost naturally go to this really progressive view of school and kind of touchy-feely and maybe a little fuzzy. And I think when I think about a school that might do a really good job, I could also envision a military school.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Where they have a very clear sense of supporting young people to have their identity, where they have a very clear attention to the physical and the mental health, where even in that construct where there's a lot of structure, they provide a lot of student agency and allow for a lot of choice making by students. So you can imagine environments where, like, very different approaches still root themselves in the same science and evidence and come up with very different and still aspire to the very same kinds of outcomes for young people.
Yeah, this is music to my ears.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Jim Shelton, head of the education arm of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, on how we come up with the answers on how to help kids at a lot of different schools, a lot of different cultures. And it sounds like there's not one size fits all.
I think by very definition, the one thing that the science is clear about that feels visceral for people is that almost every single child is different and needs different things, and they're in different environments. And so what's going to work for whom in what context requires us to be able to adjust to all of those things. And if we know that that's true, now we just need to figure out how we solve that problem. I often reference the work of Benjamin Bloom about tutoring. And basically what they found that compared to a traditional classroom, you could produce, what was called two standard deviations, basically a 50th percentile kid to the 98th percentile with an individual tutor. And I think it's sad that that became known as the two sigma, meaning the two standard deviations problem, because people realized you could actually do this with kids. And then the problem became, where do you get all the money and where do you get all the people? Well, if that's the question, then let's stop blaming kids and let's start figuring out how do you create those kind of learning experiences and learning environments at a price point we're willing to pay for as a society. And I'm willing to have that conversation with anybody. I'm excited about the values that people bring to the importance of education and all the cultural things that happen in school that are important to protect as well. I have very little patience for the people who are unwilling to try different things in order to, when they recognize fully, we all recognize that we are not providing those kind of experiences and learning environments for all kids today. And so, I get tackled a lot for, innovation is a bad word in our sector. And I, at the same time, if we don't aspire to find better ways to do new things to meet the needs of all children, we're not going to achieve our aspirations.
I think people are afraid to have their kids be guinea pigs. I mean, as a parent, I know that sounds scary, but they have to trust in people like you.
Well, I would say is they don't need to trust in people like me. What they need to trust in is the adults that are in their classroom every day. And what I would say about that is that what happens today, whether people like to admit it or not, is they're experimenting with their kids today. In classrooms, there's no structure around it. Teachers go in and they try a new lesson plan. They try a new tool. They try a new resource. And they are doing that with the best of intentions to try and meet the needs of their students. And oftentimes, they don't have any other supports or tools around them so they can learn well from the experience, so other teachers can learn from their experience, so they can know whether what they think worked, and whether it worked well for everyone. And if we just get better at that process of helping the very thing that teachers do on a daily basis to try and get better, get a lot more support, a lot more clear and better tools to help them do that work, that would be a huge step forward. But then we've got people like you and the other people at the Graduate School of Education that are like their whole careers around researching these big questions about how to improve education. What if you could, in a much more systematic way, get the insights that they're gaining in the hands of the teachers and the students and their parents, and vice versa? What if the insights that the teachers and the students and the parents were having, we were much better at getting those in the hands of the researchers so they could actually turn it into the next best thing? Like, we're just really terrible at that, and we could get much better, much more quickly. Yeah, I think we'd all be better off.
Hallelujah. I'm with him. I'm following him wherever he goes.
No, me too. Although I'm sort of in the back saying, I have the answer. I have the answer.
Well, it sounds like he's going to ask you as he tries to work with the different schools of education. But that's for a whole other show. Right now, I want to just thank everyone for listening to Schools In. Thank you, Jim Shelton, for being a fabulous guest. And if you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or SiriusXM Insight 121.